Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. Today I have with me from Guyana, Indo-Caribbean author Premi Mohammed.
In my stories, I kind of wanted to be like, if we look at a situation that doesn't exist, so we can ask some questions about what does exist.
We'll be talking about her 2021 short story, The Arrival of the New World.
I think what I wanted to probe into there was that oil was discovered in Guyana, and it makes me really think about what we would call like Caribbean futurisms. Like, what is going to happen to the Caribbean specifically as time goes on along two axes, which I'm looking at in this story, which is like one axis is that more money, possibly lots of money, is going to be flowing into a historically very, very poor place because of the oil. And secondly, at the same time, and along a distant axis, that climate change is coming right along with it. Like, how are they going to cope with both those things? What's the path through?
Premi, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Gerald. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. It's been a while. We've been trying to do this for a while now. So I'm happy that we're finally here. Before we get into talking about this particular story and others, tell us about how you came to be associated as an SF writer and what was that journey like for you?
It does feel like a journey because, growing up, we actually had a lot of books in the house. But they were all nonfiction because neither of my parents read very much fiction. Mm-hmm. We had maybe a handful of novels in the house, and I think they were all gifts, and I don't think my parents read them. So where I got most of my books from was the school library or the public library. And so at first, I think it was just, you know, as a reader, it was kind of the natural attraction of a young kid to kind of the literature of the imagination. Like, I wanted to read about dragons, I wanted to read about magic, I wanted to read about spaceships. And then when I was, you know, a little bit older, sort of 12 or 13, like making up my own stories and starting to write, that's what felt most natural to me. And of course, you know, at first it was all very imitative. Like, I would be telling myself I was inventing an original story, but really, when you look at the story, I was trying to rewrite like Lord of the Rings or The Chronicles of Brightane or Edgar Rice Burroughs Mars stories or whatever. But yeah. I think what appealed to me as I got older, kind of the journey, was the ability in sci-fi and fantasy to kind of speak next to reality instead of about it, you know, if that makes sense. Like, the way the books use setting and technology and magic and philosophy and values and beliefs and cultures that don't exist, that are pure works of the writer's imagination and effort and research to speak about our reality. I thought there was a lot to be said for sci-fi and fantasy's ability to use kind of allegory and metaphor. And so the reader has to kind of meet the writer halfway, and they both have to use their imagination. And I find that really gratifying, like to be able to say, what if the world was different, instead of what if the world was the world, you know?
We do tend to put writers in certain blocks. I am guilty of it myself as a literature nut. But if you had to describe it for yourself, what is it? What is the Premi Mohammed SF brand look like?
Well, that's my brand. Yeah, you know, I've also seen that. And it's funny because the author is almost never the one who puts those categories on there. It's usually the publisher. It's usually actually, it's not even like the editor. It's the marketing department. I would say, yeah, I've written cosmic horror. I've written dark fantasy. I've also written sci-fi.
Yeah.
I've written stuff that I think would approach surrealism and magic realism. And I should also add, I don't come from a literary background or education, so I've really had to pick up all these definitions as I go along. I think I always say speculative fiction because I think that's the umbrella that covers everything. Yeah. But for sure, starting off, I did not realize that readers kind of pigeonhole you based on your first novel. Not so much, because by the time my first novel came up, I had had, I don't know, 20 something short stories published in a variety of genres. And then when I had books like, The Annual Migration of Clouds or And What Can We Offer You Tonight, which came out in 2021, which are both sci-fi, I had readers contacting me like, I thought this was going to be a cosmic horror. I write everything. And I think speculative fiction is the easiest. It's the easiest box and the biggest box.
People listening to us so far, listening to you particularly, they wouldn't know that you actually have Caribbean heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that right now. And what does it mean to identify as an Indo-Caribbean writer? And where do you see it emerging, whether consciously or unconsciously, in your work so far?
Yeah, I didn't really start thinking about this, as bad as it sounds, until a few years ago, actually. And I think partly because I was born in Canada. I've only been back to Guyana, where my parents are from, once. And I haven't set things, except for that single story that you mentioned at the start, actually in Guyana or the Caribbean, because I felt like I didn't have enough knowledge to write about it from that interior perspective, respectfully. So initially, I didn't think it was showing up in my writing. And my parents came here to Canada in, I was going to say a year, I'm just going to say the late 70s. They moved to Toronto, and then they came out here to Edmonton. And they kind of pushed me and my brother to really assimilate to whiteness, to Westernness, as much as possible, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we and they kind of didn't really have a choice, because being away from the rest of the family in Guyana and Toronto and New York, like, they were cut off from their Guyanese and Caribbean cultural identity as well, like, to the parts of the culture that ensured continuity, to the parts of the culture that they could pass on to us. But I have really been looking at my own work, particularly now that the short story collection is out, and that people are finding, reviewers are finding themes and commonalities that they're seeing there that I kind of didn't realize while I was writing each individual story without thinking about the other stories. I think where it comes out is thinking about really colonization and taking an anti-colonial stance in my stories, about one people encountering another people, which happens so much in fantasy and sci-fi, and saying, your land and your resources and you yourselves now belong to us, which I think permeates a lot of my writing. And I'm trying to look more closely at how I unconsciously represent the power imbalance, the sense of entitlement, the idea of manifest destiny, which of course we think about a lot in Canada as well, like the lack of awareness of colonizers, their justifications for doing what they're doing, why they're wrong, and why the people who have been colonized should be angry because they were wronged, and why colonization is not a neutral or beneficial thing. And particularly, And actually, I'm teaching about this later this fall, I think, and possibly next spring, more about cosmic horror. You know, you see that a lot in the older stories, you know, H.P. Lovecraft and Algernon Blackwood and more of the kind of the North American writers. Like the colonizers in North and South America, white man mostly, are appalled that they themselves may be colonized by eldritch beings, these ancient gods, and they never seem to explicitly realize the irony and the hypocrisy that they were the ones who showed up and subjugated an entire like global hemisphere practically and committed genocide on the indigenous peoples living there. And now the same thing is happening to them. And their argument is in the, you know, in these older stories, oh, we're human beings and we don't deserve it. Like, what does that tell you about how they thought about the human beings they killed and tortured and enslaved previously, right?
When I was doing my homework on you, okay, I came across a review of No One Will Come Back for Us by Katie MacIver, and Katie described the stories, your stories, as dark, concerned with systems of belief and sacrifice, with the forces both real and unseen. And I was thinking, as you were just talking, when you mentioned colonization and anti-colonial stances, that could very much fit that review, that description, when you think of a force both real and unseen. That's
Yes.
colonization. But it's also anti-colonial stances, right? How do we confront those forces, both real and unseen? But in terms of the review, what other forms of belief systems, what other kinds do you find yourself confronting or acknowledging more consciously?
Yeah. You know, I didn't actually realize again until those reviews started coming out, or the interviews. There was one with Arlie Sorg in Clerks World. I didn't realize that so many of my stories were concerned with this kind of constructed belief system, or this very like simplistic or oversimplified religious system that kind of builds story by story. And I think what I kind of wanted to acknowledge was the gaps and unknowns in all religious systems, because I think particularly in sci-fi, there tends to not be a lot of mention of faith, of organized religion. A lot of sci-fi kind of implies that the future is going to be, oh, you know, everyone's going to worship artificial intelligences, or everyone's going to be an atheist. And you know, growing up, like my mom is Hindu, my dad is Muslim. They sent me and my brother to Catholic school for 12 years. Like, we had a lot of questions about religion and like the purposes of it, why it should be part of our lives. Like, did it earn a place in our lives? What was the point? And we both ended up agnostic, actually. But in my stories, I kind of wanted to be like, again, you know, speaking next to reality, what if we look at a situation that doesn't exist so we can ask some questions about what does exist? Like, what if the gods were real enough to see and they made demands of us and we were punished for not complying? And you know, again, that feeds back to this kind of colonial belief, the particularly like white European Christian beliefs of manifest destiny and the great chain of being, this kind of transactional, you owe us, like this is a transaction. What does that mean for the system of belief where the gods are real? Like, how does that change our behavior towards the gods and to each other? Like in school, I don't know if you guys got this, but in school we were told to behave because God was watching us. And like, no one really believed that past a certain age, I don't think. But in these stories, what if they really were? Like, what if you could see them outside your house? What if they never tell you why they want you to do what you're told? You know, what if you spend your whole life trying to figure it out, or do you ignore it? And so the religious aspects, you know, these ancient gods, these new gods, kind of encompasses everything else that I'm trying to if not dismantle, because that's hard in a short story, but, you know, at least examine like colonialism and classism and ableism and what makes us human rather than divine, or what makes us human rather than animal, and what makes life worth living or defending or dying for if the gods won't tell us and aren't communicating with us.
This idea of what it means to be Guyanese or from the Caribbean or Indo-Caribbean, or this idea of being an island girl. You know, anything you want to talk about in terms of your Indo-Caribbean identity and what you were giving readers to ponder about when reading this particular story? And for those who haven't read it yet, what are you hoping they kind of grasp or take away from it?
Yeah, oh my God. See, this was a really interesting story for me. And, you know, when we were emailing, which readers obviously can't see, and you were checking to see kind of which stories we might want to discuss on the podcast, and I thought, you know, yeah, that's the only one that's explicitly set back in Guyana. And the narrator is a definite self-insert character, one of very few, I think. Like, she feels like an outsider and she's treated as one. And that kind of goes back to how I feel, because, you know, I was born in Canada, but even when I'm back with family in Toronto, like, I feel white. I'm not Guyanese enough. Yeah. I'm not Caribbean enough. I wrote this story specifically for a solicit, the editor of the Golang's book of South Asian Sci-Fi Volume 2 contacted me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, well, I'd better write, you know, a South Asian story. But I can't, because I've never been to India. And I thought, literally, this is what white writers struggle with when we discuss cultural appropriation. An outsider trying to write from the perspective of an insider and doing it wrong and doing it disrespectfully and being appropriative of things that are specific to the culture. So, like, I visited Guyana once. I was 16. That was the summer between high school and university, because I started university at 16, which was just a super bad idea.
Yeah.
And I went with my mom. My brother and my dad did not want to come with us, actually, which was surprising. So my mom and I went. We went for almost a month. We stayed with my uncle, her brother. He had a house in Georgetown. We drove into Enmore, which is where my parents were from. And she hadn't been back for like 20 years or something like that. And she just fit right in. And I just didn't. And people kind of looked at me and knew even before I opened my mouth. You know, I felt very embarrassed. I felt ostracized, othered, even by family. And even these days, what I've been trying to do for the last couple of years, particularly as my parents get older, is I'm trying to, like, pump them for information. I'm like, you know, tell me the stories that you guys heard when you were a kid. Tell me, do you have any folklore about Enmore? Did you have any mythology? Were there stories? What did your parents tell you for bedtime stories? And they tell me, you know, oh, there's nothing. We don't remember anything. We never heard those stories. We don't have anything to pass on to you. And I'm, you know, okay, I'm a little surprised. I'm also a little envious of my other Canadian, Caribbean friends who did hear those stories. I think of my friend Susan Palumbo, who incorporates, she's from Trinidad, and incorporates Trinidadian mythology into her stories. And, you know, there's stories about witches and jumbies and things like that. And I'm like, oh, again, for me, that feels appropriative, because I should be getting that from my family, and I'm not. Now that's something I'm going to have to research. So in the story, I thought about it for a really long time, and I finally thought, if I'm an outsider, let's lean into that. Let's lean into that. So the narrator is an outsider, and she's back to study and investigate rather than reconnect, rather than try to blend in and say that she's something she's not. She just says, you know, so I'm an outsider. That's the best thing for a journalist to be. She's coming at it from a different perspective than the people living there, which of course almost ends in disaster, which I thought it was constantly going to do when I was there in Guyana, because that's the other problem with being an outsider. You don't know the truth of the place, the land, the people, and that's not something you can persuade them to tell you necessarily. So they don't. And it was interesting for me because perhaps unusually, I have no idea. My parents don't really want me or my brother to go back to Guyana to write or study or anything. They never have. We have very few family members still there. They all emigrated to New York or Toronto or Ottawa. And their attitude was kind of like, we escaped and we're not looking back. And I always wondered, what were they escaping? What was it really like? You know, that's partly where that story came from, is what aren't they telling me? Why aren't they telling me that? And is that in and of itself a story? Because to me, that's a huge part of my identity. That's an enormous gap that I feel slightly hurt by, and that a lot of my other friends who are children of immigrants, they don't have that gap because their parents were really diligent in telling them the stories and myths and folklore of where they had come from.
You capture certain elements that I've seen by different other Guyanese writers, Wilson Harris, to name the one that most jumps out at me, but also more recently, Iman Baksh, who, and anyone listening, I had Iman Baksh on this show as well from Guyana. But what you're doing in your story, there are familiar elements, and the rainforest is one of those. And the rainforest trope or idea appears a lot in a lot of Guyanese fiction, non-fiction, I suppose, as well. What were your influences, if any, any specific Guyanese writers who you grew up with, or their imagination about the rainforest? Anything, was anything there, or how did you conceive of the rainforest from your perspective?
Oh man, you know, so I've actually never read any Wilson Harris, I am ashamed to say. Or actually any other Guyanese writers, except for maybe a few current poets like Rajiv Mohabir, who's part of the diaspora, actually. And, you know, researching for this interview, I looked up Wilson Harris and was like, oh, I have to read Harris for sure. So I guess, you know, the answer for how they've informed my work is unfortunately zero. But I can tell you, I really had an idea about the rainforest before I actually went into the rainforest in Guyana. And I just had all my illusions shattered instantly.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, okay, so it's not like Fern Gully. Let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, the bugs. But like, you know, the difference between even a temperate rainforest, because, you know, if you go to like Vancouver Island, that's a temperate rainforest. So technically I had been to a rainforest before, but like, the diversity and the density and the noise and the heat and the humidity and the giant ants. Yeah. And I was like, this is, you know, and again, I'm 16 years old. I'm never going to forget this trip. This is a place where you have to be an insider to survive. This is not a place that outsiders will do well in. And, you know, if you don't respect it, and colonizers respect nothing, you will just die here. It would be very easy to die here. And I think part of me was thinking, you know, we ended up as British Guyana, but there were also like the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish, and everybody had a crack at it. And part of me was like, well, you know, if I wanted to colonize Guyana, I would stay on the coast because the rainforest is just unbelievable. Like, if you're from Spain and you go into the rainforest, you're just going to drop dead. But I was very, very, you know, I was overwhelmed. I was awed. We had a trip planned out to Kaichur Falls and we didn't end up going because my uncle wasn't feeling well and we didn't want to go without him. And like, I kept thinking, the rainforest tells you about the world. It's the world in microcosm. To me, it almost felt like, it felt in itself like a novel. Like, it's complex, it all works together, it's resilient up to a point, and it doesn't exist to be exploited. And if you do exploit it, it'll tip over into something that is not what it is. And when I was there in 98, that was happening to a degree in Guyana. They were slashing and burning rainforests so that they could have cattle there. And we're also seeing that happen in Brazil. And as the rainforest dries out, you're seeing these huge, huge fires that destroy parts of it that probably have never burned before in its entire history of evolution as a rainforest. And I kept thinking, I want to write about this more. And then I keep thinking, well, no, that makes me a fraud. Like, I've only been there once. I was only there for a month. We spent a lot of our time in the city. We only went into the actual forest itself 3 or 4 times, with my cousins, because I was begging to go because I was so curious. Do I have the experience to write about this? Do I have the knowledge to write about this? And if not, how can I get it? Can I read writers who write from that first person experiential perspective like Harris? And is that going to be enough? You know, it's one of those things where I don't have imposter syndrome for a lot of what I do, but I do about my own identity and where it appears in my fiction and whether I have the credentials to let it appear in my fiction, you know?
You mentioned the ethics, and something that I noticed in this story as well. There are references to oil money, and I found this, I was interested in this because we're kind of seeing it played out, I mean, after your story was published, but this idea of, you know, the ethics behind oil, I don't know, anything you wanted to explore with that aspect of oil money in this story, and how that kind of like blended with, you know, the cosmic and the dark fantasy side of things.
Yeah. So this gets into some really heavy questions, doesn't it? And I'm from Alberta, which is oil country. So this also is part of my identity. I got a degree in land reclamation in Alberta. 90% of the reclamation that you're doing is for oil and gas. I used to work for an oil company. While I was consulting, the vast majority of my income came from consulting for oil companies. Till recently, I was working for the government, and most of the policy that we were writing was for oil companies. And I think about it a lot. I think about its effects on, you know, not just the environment, but also the economy and the society that oil is in and how it changes how people think about it. I don't think anyone's going to argue that Albertans really don't think about oil and gas the same way the rest of the country does, which is absolutely ridiculous to watch. It's actually kind of scary. But what I thought about with Guyana, because, you know, it was quite recent that oil was discovered in Guyana, right? Just what was that, like 5-7 years ago, something like that? Really very recent. And it makes me really think about like what, as again, kind of an umbrella term, what we would call like Caribbean futurisms. Like, what is going to happen to the Caribbean specifically as time goes on along two axes, which I'm looking at in this story, which is like one axis is that more money, possibly lots of money, is going to be flowing into a historically very, very poor place because of the oil. And secondly, at the same time, and along a distant axis, that climate change is coming right along with it. Like, how are they going to cope with both those things? What's the path through? And is it kind of like, you know, like, is it, are they going to take that new immense wealth and use it to immediately implement mitigation strategies? Because the one thing you can't do, no matter how much money you have, is move where you live, right? Yeah. Like, you know, are they going to focus on renewable energy like solar for when the grid is disrupted by hurricanes, or like hydrogeological solutions, levees and seawalls and pumps and flood proof or hurricane proof or earthquake proof houses? like tidal energy, offshore wind turbines, improved living conditions for people, reforestation, conservation of wildlife and plants? Or are they going to take the money and do the same thing that oil states all over the world do, which is make everything worse? Like, yeah. We already know, you know, we've known for centuries, and of course the people who have been living there for millennia, we know the Caribbean has historically been in a bad spot geographically for natural disasters. Now those are only going to get worse, no matter how much money you have or don't have. And, you know, it can't be ignored. I suspect they are going to ignore it, but from my perspective, like, this cries out for sci-fi, like, yeah. for people writing near future imaginings of maybe the one place in the world, the Caribbean, that could use its newfound oil wealth while people are still buying oil to make itself the most disaster-proof place possible, because they can do that now and because that's what they're thinking about. Maybe it won't happen. And from a fantasy perspective, I would want to know, you know, what do the myths and folklore of the Caribbean say about this kind of disaster? Like, what would their response be? How would they interact with people now with all this money coming in, all this possible resource exploration and exploitation? Does that make it a horror story? I don't know. I really think this is going to be a very fruitful area for fiction in the next, I don't know, the next forever. I would like to see how it plays out, because I think we all have a lot of ideas about how it could play out.
Yeah, I was reading ahead of this, because I know I wanted to ask you about this because I saw it in the story, but I was reading ahead of this that we're talking about this on July 17th. I saw an article last week saying that Guyana is poised to average 1.2 million barrels of oil per day.
Oh my God.
By the end of 2027. and this was mentioned by the current president, Dr. Irfan Ali. So, and another article, ExxonMobil is projected to have Guyana as their number one oil producer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also begs the question again, that interaction with the rainforest. Yeah. Where is this oil? Are they going to be destroying rainforests to get to it?
Yeah.
Are they going to be contaminating it with, you know, with flare pits and pipelines and oil refineries? And are we going to see, you know, disasters? Are we going to see more environmental disasters in Guyana's relatively relatively untouched areas of the rainforest? What's going to happen to the indigenous communities that are already living there? Are they going to benefit? Is it going to be a disaster? I'm worried about this. Like,
you mentioned in the story, it says, now they have oil, the rainforest will be left alone. And we're thinking, it's not really going to be left alone, is it?
Probably not.
So you do allow us to think deeply about those kinds of questions. We talked about the story that you've written, and we're kind of winding down now. I see you have something carded for next year. The Butcher of the Forest. Do you want to talk to us about that? And what we could probably expect from you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Thank you. that's my first release next year. Yeah. And that's actually a, oh my God, that's a made up folklore story set in some ambiguous place that is never named. And actually, now that we're talking about it, it's another story of colonizer and colonized. Yeah. So a dictator has moved into this country along with his family after conquering it and killing a lot of people in the War of Conquest. And just like we're saying, like a lot of colonizers, he doesn't know enough about the land he's colonized to avoid the dangers. So his children go missing in the forest, and he coerces a local woman to find them and bring them out alive, even though the woods are magical and incredibly dangerous. And in general, no one does make it out. So it's kind of looking at, you know, it's a fairy tale, but it looks explicitly at that power imbalance, like how there are people you can't say no to as a colonized person, but how you can also try to effect change in a colonized country from the ground up. you know, even if you feel powerless, even if it may not happen in a single generation. And I love that a friend of mine described it as Escape from LA meets Hansel and Gretel, which I just love. So yeah, looking forward to that one.
It definitely sounds exciting. I mean, fairy tales just have this inherent dark underbelly, don't they?
Yes, so dark.
But Premi, this is so good talking to you. Before you go though, anything else you want to mention? Maybe that we didn't touch on?
For people who might want to read more of my short stories that are kind of horror and dark fantasy and dark sci-fi, my short story collection, No One Will Come Back for Us, just came out in May from Undertow Publications. So that's available everywhere. And then I think I have 3 books coming out next year, but probably the less said about that, the better.
Yeah.
It's going to be a busy year. But if people want to find me, I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Premisaurus, and on my website at premimohammed.com. And God, this was really interesting. Thanks
Excellent.
So much.
So I'll link your website in the description so listeners can check out. Premi, I want to thank you again so much for doing this.
No, thank you.
And to everyone listening, thank you as well. Continue to stay tuned to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.